Hey, good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High with you this morning. Hope your day is going well. Currently outside, it is 79 degrees. We're expecting a high in the upper 90s. Heat indices getting near 110 today. So another very hot day here in the SEK. So be sure to drink plenty of water and take frequent breaks in the shade if you can. Well, joining us now, it's time for Greenside Up. And we have in studio with us this morning are Jesse Gilmore and James Coover. And gentlemen, good morning. How are you doing today?
Pretty good.
Good morning.
It's good to have you guys in studio this morning. And we'll go ahead and get started. I'm going to go ahead and have Jesse start this morning here during the first segment. And Jesse, you're talking about a few things, including the Master Gardener program and a few other things as well, correct?
Yeah, so we'll start with the Master Gardener program and then kind of touch on some of the problems we're seeing in the landscape right now, because I've gotten a few repeat calls, and so it's probably a good idea to let you everyone listening know about armyworms and cutworms, which is a problem we're seeing in turf right now, and some oak diseases that will be common in our landscape with how frequently people plant oaks. But starting out with the Extension Master Gardener program, we are getting ready to start training our 2021 Master Gardeners. Extension Master Gardeners is a program that started in the 70s at Washington State University. Of course, most gardening stuff will start in the Pacific Northwest. But basically, it was a way to get volunteers cooperating with Extension that can go out and basically teach and volunteer out in the community for landscape and garden related stuff. Every state will have its own Master Gardener program, and it kind of varies from state to state, but our Master Gardener program went online last year because of COVID. And we are continuing to do online, but we are also starting to work back in person. And doing it online was kind of nice because it allowed for some of the counties out in western Kansas that didn't really have a ton of people interested in the Master Gardener program to still have the people who were interested basically get that education. Because traditionally, before we went online, specialists would come down and do teaching on their topics of specialization. However, because online happened, everyone could access the specialists without needing the specialists to travel to their specific county. So it was a lot more accessible. But people were interested in doing it in person, and we are planning on doing an in-person group at the Southeast Research Extension Center in Parsons. The applications are online. The in-person classes will be 6 or 7 weeks, whereas the online classes sitting in front of a screen can be pretty daunting for long periods. So what they do is they do one topic per week for about 13 to 14 weeks. The first class will be on September 2nd, so we need to have applications in by the end of August if you are interested. Just give our office a call and I'll get you that info, and hopefully we'll get a good group of people ready to get out into the community and volunteer.
And then, of course, you said you wanted to bring up some things happening with, like, armyworms, I think is what you said, and just a few things going on out there. You're getting a lot, like you said, you're getting a lot of repeat callers on stuff.
Yeah, so this week I've answered probably about 4 different people's questions on how to control armyworms. Armyworms are a larval the larval form of quite a few different moth species, and they're going to be feeding on turf like crazy. The people who have called me recently have said they've found hundreds and hundreds in their yard. And that can be quite problematic, especially if, you know, you're in a more city-type area where people frequently use their yards, and even out in, like, rural areas, especially along the borders of crop fields is where they're most common. They will feed on turf. And for cool season grasses, especially right now when they're dormant, that can be really problematic and cause some turf dieback in patches, in irregular patches, which is problematic because people like consistent lawns a lot of the time. So spraying some kind of insecticide to control them would be very beneficial for the health of your yard right now, especially since fescue is probably the most common grass we have down here. There's a lot of insecticides that are labeled for control of armyworms and cutworms. So what you pick as far as your active ingredient goes will be primarily based on the availability in your area. Insecticides like bifenthrin, cyfluthrin, those are the two probably most effective insecticides that you would want to look for. But the label, many different insecticides will work. And if you do have questions about any insecticides that you might want to try using on armyworms or cutworms, give our office a call. I've sent that publication out to quite a few people, and it will have a list of probably about 10 to 15 different insecticide chemicals that would be effective at controlling armyworms.
So do armyworms... what do they look like? Say you're out and about in the field, or maybe you're at home in your yard. What do they look? Do they just look like, you know, normal? What do they look like? What is something we can look for?
Armyworms are 1 inch to maybe 2 inches long with a black stripe running down the top of them. Cutworms are going to be smaller and more.
They've got yellow stripes down the middle. Down the back of them.
They do have stripes, too?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's
so,
the shade of the stripe that kind of helps determine. And some will actually have dots along the back on their backside, too. And so of the 4 to 5 different species, you can kind of determine it fairly easy by that.
Yeah, and you'll also really be able to tell whether you have armyworms or cutworms based on where the feeding damage occurs, because cutworms are going to be feeding down at the base of the grass blade, where it goes in and forms its roots, where they cut it off at ground level. Armyworms are going to be feeding from the top down, so you're going to see a lot of your damage on the tips of the blades. And even if you can't really ID the difference between armyworms and cutworms, they're going to be controlled pretty much the same way in turf. Anything that's labeled for armyworms should also be labeled for cutworms, because they're both, you know, caterpillar-type insects, same feeding habits, and many mechanisms of action that insecticides go through will be effective on both of them. But yeah, they look pretty similar, so they can be hard to tell apart at a glance. So feeding damage is also one of the best ways to tell them apart.
And like you said, but basically the treatment for them are basically the same for armyworms and cutworms. Just if you have cutworms and you get something that says armyworms, it's going to take care of them anyway, correct?
Yep. And it's always important to check the label of any insecticide you buy. If the insect that you're trying to control is not on the list of insects that it's labeled for, it could kill what you're trying to control. It could not. There's two possibilities for why it's not on the list. The first, it wasn't tested for that particular insect, so it could be effective. The second, it was not proven effective at controlling the insect you want to control. The label is always the law with any pesticide you spray, be that insecticide, herbicide, or fungicide. So you definitely want to follow the label, and you want to get something that's labeled for what you're trying to control. Yeah, if you spray it and it's labeled for armyworms and cutworms, it's going to control both of them the same.
Yeah, the thing I've been having trouble with at my place this year has been ants. I mean, ants are all over the place this year. I don't know what the deal is. I would have thought with the hard freeze we had earlier this year that may have killed off a lot of them. No, it actually seems like they're worse this year than they have been any other year.
Oh, it is so interesting how many people have said that. For most insects that I've been called out to check, they are much worse in populations than last year. Ticks, mosquitoes, pretty much everything except Japanese beetles are worse than they were last year. And I guess if you're going to have one insect that is controlled by a freeze, you would want it to be Japanese beetles, because they are such voracious feeders and they're very general in what they feed on. So you can see damage on a ton of different landscape plants. So yeah, Japanese beetles, I guess, is the one that I would want the freeze to control the most. But there are some other problem insects that are showing up. armyworms being the one that is most common right now. As far as ants go, are they carpenter ants or are they just plain old like house ants?
Well, I've seen them. There's some that are like inside the house, which I've been able to somewhat control with some bait. I mean, there's a ton of these ants in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just trying to find their spots where they're coming in at and spraying those areas down. But there's some also on my ramp here into the house that, and that ramp is wood.
Yep.
And they're just like crawling all over this thing. And no matter how much I spray it and kill them off, and I come back a couple hours later, and there they are again. They just won't go away. So I don't know if those are carpenter ants as well. But I think I may have a little both because they all look a little bit different. It seems like the ones on the ramp are bigger than the ones that are coming into the house.
Yeah. Carpenter ants, in my experience, they prefer natural wood like trees. I have not really seen them as structural pests as often. For any ant that you're experiencing problems with around a house, finding the spot where they get in is the first step. And then the second step, I would say, is probably putting down diatomaceous earth. It's essentially, the best way to describe it is it's like glass to insect bodies. It forms a physical barrier, and when they try to crawl over it, their bodies are essentially shredded. So it's not a chemical in the same way that most insecticides are, but it's more of a physical barrier that prevents them from getting to the spot where they get into the house. And putting that around the area where they get in will cut down immensely on any ants that might try to find their way in. The only problem with diatomaceous earth is that, you know, we have a lot of wind in Kansas, and because it's a powder, it can sometimes be carried off by the wind. So it would need occasional replacing to make sure that you have enough there to prevent the ants from getting by. But it's not a chemical, so you're not going to have any toxicity issues. It's safe for people and pets. It's only really dangerous for insects, and those are the things you're trying to control. But yeah, carpenter ants, kind of tricky to control because most of the things that they feed on, they don't eat the wood that they chew on. They're basically just trying to chew the wood up so that they can form galleries and tunnels to lay their eggs in. So in trees, you can't apply systemic insecticides and expect them to ingest the chemical because they're not eating the wood. So
now there is a tree right by this ramp, so I don't know if that's playing a part in it or not.
It could be, and it's definitely worth checking occasionally because carpenter ants, while they won't kill a tree on their own, they create a lot of openings for decay to get into wood. So it's definitely worth observing the tree and spraying any ants that might be, you know, chewing the wood out of the inner vascular tissue underneath the bark. You will need a contact insecticide, though. And then real quick, I wanted to touch on oak diseases before we go on to the break, because we are seeing some oak problems right now. There are three major oak diseases hitting right now. There's Tubacchia leaf spot. There is, it's called bot canker, and I can't remember what bot is short for. And then there's bur oak blight. Two of these diseases will be affecting white oaks, and one Tubacchia leaf spot will be affecting primarily red oaks. The difference between red and white oaks is that red oaks have pointed leaves, while white oaks will have rounded leaves. They are all foliar diseases, so you might be seeing some defoliation of your oak tree right about now. All of them will be mostly aesthetic and not affect the long-term health of the tree. The defoliation is a little bit concerning, but the one thing that you can do to check and see if any bare branches are still alive is the flex test. You go out to the end of a branch and you flex it, and if it is brittle, it's been cut off from its water and nutrients, and it is either dead or will die back to the branch. But if it's still flexible when you bend it, it's still getting water and nutrients, so you know that the disease is basically limited to the leaves at that point and won't affect the long-term health of the tree. For any disease that does defoliate trees, though, you do want to kind of baby it through its disease problems, because you don't want to compound stress on stress. And a heat index of, I think you said, 110?
We're having heat index near 110 today.
Yeah, so heat like that, drought on disease stresses can be problematic, can cause other problems and what's known as not a death spiral per se, because there's not a chance that it'll die, but the tree will not flourish like it could. So you do want to give it occasional soakings, especially if you're seeing disease problems. You don't want to overwater. For mature trees, about once every 7 days that we're not forecasted to get rain should be good, and about 5 to 10 minutes. Oaks are nice in that they get a lot of surface water because they spread their roots out instead of down. So they will need a soaking probably farther out than most trees will, that you would want to water down.
All right. Well, Jesse, some good stuff there for us this morning. If anybody wants to get a hold of you, how can they do that?
They can call the Girard office at 620-724-8233 or email me at jr637@ksu.edu.
All right. We got about 30 seconds here, but James is going to come over to you real quick and just kind of preview what you're going to talk about here in the second segment of our show.
Yeah, so I'm going to be talking about soil pH, which is, you know, something that affects literally all parts of agriculture and gardening and pretty much everything. And so everything outside is affected by soil pH, and fall is a good time to get a lot of that stuff corrected.
All right, and we will talk about that in the second part of our program starting at around 8:10, but we do need to go ahead and take a break. We got news coming up from Fox and also some local news from Matt Jordan. And welcome back to Open Line, not Open Line, but Green Side Up here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High with you this morning. And back in studio with us is James Coover and Jesse Gilmore. And we'll head over to James to start this portion of the program. And James will be talking about soil pH. So, James, what is soil pH?
Yeah, so soil pH is the actual quantity of hydrogen or OH molecules within the soil itself. And so, you know, an important part of understanding soil pH is that pH is a log metric scale, which means, you know, a soil pH of 6 is actually 10 times more acidic than a soil pH of 7. A soil pH of 5 is 10 times more acidic than 6. And so people often don't realize that a small difference in soil pH is actually a magnitude of difference. And of course, soil pH, it affects literally all points of agriculture, all points of gardening. I mean, every single component within the soil is affected by soil pH. And so really, fertility doesn't even matter, as long fertility would not matter if you don't have the right balance of pH, because everything is affected by it. And so you know, when it comes to those hydrogens or the hydroxide ions within the soil, a lot of those are going to bind to various elements, and all those things will be affected by it. And so, like phosphorus, for instance, you know, as you go along through the pH scale of 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 to 8, the forms of phosphorus are actually changing throughout that period. And so as it gets more acidic, the phosphorus ion, the PO4 actually, the phosphate, is going to be attaching onto more and more hydrogen ions. And plants, of course, they have an ability to absorb a specific forms of phosphorus, but not all of them. And so, you know, the plant would prefer to absorb the HPO4. And it's not very good at absorbing the H3PO4. And so a lot of these things can be affected. And, of course, you know, in the beginning, phosphorus is controlled by iron. Then it's controlled by aluminum. And then it's controlled by calcium as you get higher and higher on the pH scale. And so, you know, it is an actual chemical effect of those hydrogens within the soil that are binding onto things. And iron, for instance, if you have a pH below 5.5, iron actually becomes a toxic element. And so it's absorbed so well by the plant that it can no longer resist it. It actually can burn the roots of plants. It's not like a chemical burn, but it is it looks like actual burn. And then, of course, a pH of above 7.5, it ends up being that iron becomes so bound within the soil that the plant can't absorb it. And so, you know, that's something that Jesse might see quite a bit in trees, actually.
And I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's binding to the hydroxide ions in the soil, and because there's more hydroxide ions at higher pHs, that defines what a basic soil is, it's in the form that the plants can't use it. And almost always when we see iron deficiency, especially in the garden, it's not that there's not enough iron in the soil, it's just that the iron is in a form that's unavailable to the plant because of pH issues. Mm-hmm. And so instead of adding iron to the soil, most often when I recommend a soil sample for especially for iron deficiency, I look first at the pH, and if they can lower the pH, the iron will become available to the plant, and you'll see deficiency symptoms go away that way. But there's a lot of micronutrients in gardens that are pH dependent, like boron, magnesium, and iron are the three that occur as positive ions, and therefore with more negative hydroxide ions in the soil, they'll bond to those micronutrients and make them unavailable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, within the field, you see a lot of the binding of it and the iron deficiency actually on the north side of a gravel road, because people driving by, they fluff up that the gravel, it actually drifts over the field, and over time you can actually create a high enough pH that you end up with deficiencies, especially in soybeans. And so I go out and take a look at these fields, and there's just a stripe right along the north side of a field. They think it's some sort of disease pushing into it. It's actually just dust from the gravel road, and there's nothing you can do about it in a field of that size. In a garden, you can add sulfur. In a field, you can't really add that quantity of sulfur, so it is what it is. So
all right, so again, a lot of good stuff there. So how is soil pH changed, though? Because obviously we want to change it to make it more usable, basically.
Yes, and so the primary way of lowering soil pH is, of course, lime. Lime is kind of it's from actual limestone that you have to wash and heat and they grind up into a certain amount. But it's calcium carbonate is what it is. And there's kind of a misunderstanding that lime, or that it's actually the calcium that changes the pH. It's actually the carbonate. And so it combines with the hydrogen ions to turn that into water and carbon dioxide. And so when you apply lime on a field, it actually releases carbon dioxide. And, you know, there's a small amount of water there, too, but not very much. So that calcium, however, it does help displace some of those hydrogen ions. It pops them off the soil surfaces and all the various other chemical structures. But it's not really doing the heavy lifting there. So, you know, when it comes to sulfur, and this is something for gardens more than anything else, because it's way too much sulfur for a field, to raise pH, I guess in this case to lower pH, that sulfur does something very similar in that it will actually release the hydrogen ions. I think more or less it kind of steals it from the water, actually. It steals those oxygen element from the water, and then it releases the H2O, the H part of the H2O. And so, that's how that works. And, you know, whether it's in a field or a garden or even a yard, pH can vary considerably from one area to another, especially here in Southeast Kansas. I mean, we have very variable soils, and, you know, over the listening zone of KGF, there's a lot of variation between one side of the listening area to the other. So, you know, you really need to take multiple samples of the majority of things. And so I would not trust, for a field, I would not trust a pH sample that was taken over more than 40 acres. Once you get to 40 acres, there's just no guarantee that one part of that 40 was same as another part of another 40. And so that's just kind of too much.
It could vary wildly between that entire area, could it not?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it can be expensive. I mean, you know, lime cost is can be a lot. I mean, when you're talking about fields, I mean, you could be talking about some farmers have bills of tens of thousands when it comes to liming and during their liming years. And, you know, this thousands within a field, you could cut those costs by a third sometimes. And, I mean, that could easily be tens of thousands. I mean, that third of a cost could be a lot just by doing some specific type of sampling. So whether that's grid sampling, which is in 5-acre squares or management zones, where you're talking about 20 to 40-acre zones that you just kind of do within your head. You kind of know your field well enough to know when certain areas are similar. And so I always suggest that before people start spending a lot of money on lime, first, know exactly what's in your soil, because, I mean, lime is expensive. And it's not only the cost of the lime, but actually the transportation, because application rates can be anywhere between 1 to 5 tons to the acre. And when you're talking about an 80-acre field, that's a lot of lime. That's a lot of trucks to get on there, and it can be really expensive.
So. Oh, go ahead.
In your experience, do you have to make a lot of lime recommendations for field crops? Because I know I've done a lot of soil sample recommendations, and I think maybe out of the 200 or so I filled out, one had to raise their pH, and most of them had to drop their pH using sulfur. What are some of the preferred pH ranges for field crops when compared to garden crops?
Yes. And so, yeah, a large part of the reason why that is because, you know, in crops, we're applying a lot of nitrogen. And nitrogen is acidifying compound because of its interaction within the soil. And so, you know, that's not surprising that you do that. But yeah, pretty much the majority, actually, I would say, have some sort of liming component to it. That's part of the reason why they brought me the soil sample, is because they knew that the pH was acidic. They really weren't sure how much to put on. And so, what was the other part of your question?
Are there some crops that are more acid tolerant than others?
Definitely. And so, you know, I would say when it comes to yield response, wheat is actually probably one of the most yield responsive. And so, you know, you can double your yield in wheat between an acidic field and a non-acidic. And there are some differences among varieties. However, oddly enough, it's alfalfa that has the least ability to resist acidic fields. And so it needs the highest of pHs of all of them. And I'm talking anywhere but above 6.4. I would not even attempt an alfalfa field with a pH below 6.4, just because it's very sensitive to it. With most crops, and then I'm talking about wheat, corn, soybeans, my recommendations start at 6.1. So anything below 6.1, that's when the liming starts. And, you know, we got to be careful here in Southeast. We're hit in two different ways. A, we have the oldest soil in Kansas, and we have the most acidic soil in Kansas. So that means we actually have to have the highest of pHs when it comes to all other parts of Kansas, because our subsoil is acidic as well. And we just cannot have acidic topsoil and acidic subsoil because the roots have nowhere to go. And so, you know, of all parts, I mean, we have lots and lots of little tiny fields here and there, and scattered throughout, you know, with all of our streams and rivers and such, and it splits them all up into little pieces, and all those little pieces have different soil pHs based upon their history. And so the importance of us testing our soils is more than pretty much anywhere else in the state. And so
if somebody, if a farmers want to put down some lime, how long does that process take for it to change that pH?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, after you put down lime, it actually does not take very long for that chemistry to go ahead and happen. It probably takes a couple of weeks for you to get the majority of the effect. That lime will, however, continue to deacidify the soil for a few more months. But you get the biggest wave right at the beginning of the first 2 weeks. And so usually when you're doing some sort of planting or seeding, you can go ahead and put lime on pretty much right before planting. But it's ideal to wait a couple of weeks. The reason why we like to do this in the fall is mostly because of weather. You can put lime down or sulfur down for a garden anytime, honestly. But in the fall, you know, rain's a lot more reliable. I mean, you can predict it better. It's not reliable, but you can at least predict a little better. The soil's drier, so, and farmers kind of have more time in the fall. So That's the reason why, but you can do it anytime. So.
So again, just a couple of weeks, like you said, it kind of basically it starts out heavy and then just it eventually tapers off, like you said. But how often would somebody need to redo that? Say maybe it didn't work as well as they thought it would. How often would they need to redo it? And does it matter how high the number gets? I mean, obviously it has to do with the crop, correct?
Yes, yes. And so, you know, farmers... it's pretty much every 8 to 10 years that they need to re-lime their soils. And that's a very large average because soils are highly variable. And so our heavy clay soils are the most buffered, which means it's going to take the most lime, but are also going to have that effect for a longer period of time. And so within the sandy part of, you know, maybe a little bit farther west of here in the southeast, they have to lime much more frequently, but it doesn't last as, I mean, but it takes less lime. That's actually the same thing with pastures as well. A lot of ranchers do not realize that their fields are very acidic. They're hampering their grass production and they don't know it. And, you know, when they apply lime, they're only applying lime about a third of the rate of a crop field. And so their expense is less, but it's kind of hard to justify because you're not getting quite the direct yield response. And so it is still expensive even for ranchers, but at least they get to apply less of it, you know, for the forage that they're trying to grow. And, you know, it can take, you know, 8 to 10 years. So it's an investment for sure because it's expensive.
And obviously check your basically you can get your pasture checked as well in various areas to make sure that it's still working or not.
Yes. Yeah. You know, and it's one of those things when we're applying lime, we're going for a target pH of 6.8. We're trying to get to that point so that way, you know, it's like that investment will continue to last. And so, of course, anything over 6.4 is a good pH. I mean, you know, for pretty much any crop. But if you get all the way to 6.8, at least you get a little bit of buffer. And, of course, that variability is huge within a field. And so, you know, if you try to get it right at that 6.3, 6.2, so that way it's still good enough, well, there's going to be parts of the field that are not good enough. So
right, but so it's better to get a little bit higher than that, just to be safe for the whole. Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Give yourself a little playroom, basically, so that because, like you said, a part of a pasture that they can just vary wildly throughout the pasture. So it's best to kind of maybe get that whole area up, and that way it's safe. Well, James, lots of good stuff there today, talking about, you know, soil pH and also the best way you can kind of change it. If anybody does have any more questions about what you've talked about today, or maybe a question about something else, or if they would like you to come out and visit them, how can they do that?
Yeah, they can give me a call, same as the Girard office, and so 620-724-8233, or they can email me, which is jcoover, just my first initial, last name, at ksu.edu.
All right. Well, guys, again, thank you so much today. We always love having you guys in, and we will see you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. We're going to go ahead and take a break, and when we come back, we're going to start Open Line. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day morning in Southeast Kansas.